The Reformation was an attempt to answer the most fundamental questions of life then, and those questions endure today.
Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Who is God? Who am I? Where is God found? What does God make of us? Who is Christ? What's the purpose of my life? Why does suffering happen? All those questions remain absolutely pertinent, and the answers that were given in the Reformation are absolutely relevant today.
You can meet and hear Pastor Matt Harrison making the case for the Reformation's relevancy at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, call 618-223-8385 or visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois. His name is, well, not quite a household word, but among the most well-known names of Christians in the 20th century, C.S. Lewis, known not only for his life of Christian apologetics, but also for his fiction, and deeply beloved by many Christians of all stripes. He began, of course, not so much as a Christian, but, well, initially, yes, but first part of his life was actually spent as a rather ardent atheist, a rebel against what he considered God's meddling in his life. We're going to begin part one of a three-part series on C.S. Lewis on this Thursday afternoon. Lewis the Atheist is part one. Dr. Joel Heck joins us. He's professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, visiting professor at Concordia Lutheran Seminary in Canada, and author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month, From Atheism to Christianity, the story of C.S. Lewis. Dr. Heck, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you for having me back. I'm delighted to be with you again.
Early in the book that you have recently finished on C.S. Lewis, you quote him reflecting on his time during atheism, and he said this. I want to know what he meant. He said the horror of the Christian universe was that it had no door marked exit. What did Lewis mean?
Well, I think Lewis was experiencing guilt feelings over things that he had done wrong, even though he very much suppressed and sublimated those feelings. And the idea that there might be a God to whom he was accountable, not only in this life, but in the next life, was horrifying to him. So he says that he didn't ask to be born, and then he's going to be punished for not living up to a standard that was imposed upon him against his will. So if there is an eternity, he might have to suffer eternally. And so he didn't like that aspect of the Christian faith, obviously because he hadn't understood the comfort of the gospel or the necessity of the law to have its proper impact upon a person.
So he would have, at least as an atheist, seen suicide as a kind of an escape hatch from human suffering, whatever life may bring him.
Yes, and he had very much early on, especially a Darwinian viewpoint that we are simply more highly evolved animals. When the animals die, that's the end of it for them. When we die, that's the end of it for us. So if we're just a biological phenomenon that happens to be more highly developed, there's nothing beyond this life.
He compared, again, in reflection on his move from atheism to Christianity, Lewis himself compared it to a game of chess wherein God makes four moves. What were those moves, and how did he describe it?
Yeah, those were four broad moves, and I don't think he was trying to say that there were no other moves, but those are the four main moves that God made. So the first move was the loss of his first bishop, although he never says it exactly that way. He describes the second move as a loss of his second bishop, so one can logically conclude that the first move was a loss of his first bishop. So he read a play by the Greek playwright Euripides, a play called The Hippolytus, and it brought about a sort of a melting of his mind inside of him from a very logical, rational, materialistic worldview into one that saw a meaning beyond this world, a longing for something beyond this world, what he called joy. So that's the first move. The second move, obviously, then is the loss of the second bishop. Both of these happened within a week of one another, by the way, in 1924. He read a book by a philosopher named Samuel Alexander, a book called Space, Time, and Deity. And in that book, he read about a distinction between enjoyment and contemplation, or what I would say is the distinction between experiencing something, what Lewis called enjoyment, and analyzing it, contemplation. And as he was thinking about this longing for something, but he didn't know exactly what he was longing for, he thought at first that he was just wanting to have that experience inside his mind and his emotions. And Samuel Alexander helped him to see that he was actually looking for the object of that longing that he was experiencing. And so instead of just an internal thing, it was something external. So the longing that he's experiencing from time to time, let's say when he was out in the world of nature, or when he was reading the Hippolytus or some great poem, he liked William Butler Yeats, especially at that period of his time, and William Morris's novels and some other poets. He was enjoying more of Milton and Spencer at that time, too. He began to realize that it was actually something, though he did not know what, that these experiences were pointing him to. So that was the second of the four chess moves. The third move was a little bit more difficult, but Lewis was trained in philosophy as well as literature and the classics, that is Greek and Latin language and texts, and a few other things as well, ancient history. So he had a very broad liberal arts education. And the third move was connecting this idea of joy or this longing for something that he knew not which with a term in the philosophy that he held at that time called idealism. And it was the term called the absolute with a capital A. And idealism was very popular in Oxford in the 1920s, although certainly not held today by anyone that I know of. And this idea of the absolute he later on described as God, but the philosophers called this entity, the absolute, something like a mind, but not quite a mind, something like spirit, but not the spirit or the Holy Spirit or God. And he later on described the absolute as a philosopher's way of keeping God at a distance. And so anyway, this idea of the absolute in idealism, he connected with the idea of joy. So that's the third chess move. And then the fourth chess move is checkmate in terms of chess. So the third one is check, and the fourth one is checkmate. And I think the third and the fourth moves both happened in 1930, a few months apart. So you got a pair in 1924 and a pair in 1930. And checkmate was when he realized his flaw in thinking that the absolute was just something like a mind, but definitely not God, and he actually connected it with the idea of a personal God. And that's when he makes this famous statement that he was dragged into the kingdom of God, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England, and accepted the reality that that was, in fact, God. So this is probably the first 6 days of June in 1930, and I'm dating the third chess move. It's the least certain of the four chess moves. I'm dating it in early February, and then the fourth move in June.
Talking about Lewis's early life, raised in what we might call a nominally Christian home, does he have a conscious memory of, at least in that kind of conscious sense, believing the tenets of Christianity as a boy?
Yes, he does. He did believe in Christianity. He was brought up in the Church of Ireland, which is a branch of the Church of England, so he was Anglican during those years when he was a member of a Christian church. And the ironic thing is that the period of time, a 2-year period of time when he was attending a school in Watford, England, just outside of London. That's the period when he became an atheist, but it's also the period, the first half of those 2 years, where he says he actually met people who held to the fundamental tenets of the Christian faith, and he believed them too, and discussed them, and talked about them, and tried to live according to it. So he was most definitely a Christian early on. In those early years, maybe somewhat formalized Christianity, but then he says he was 14 years of age when he became an atheist.
How does he describe that occurring?
He's a little bit fuzzy on that, at least in terms of the dating of it, but there was a matron, a lady who helped with laundry service and health care and those sorts of things for the kids in this school. So this is 1911 to 1913 for Lewis. And so in 1911, he would have been 12 years of age in the early part of that year, and then he's 14 when he leaves the school. And she was involved in various religious activities, Rosicrucianism, for instance, and some occultic dabbling, and that helped for him to spill over the edge, even though that was more the straw that broke the camel's back rather than the core or fundamental reason for him adopting atheism. That had a whole lot more to do with the death of his mother when he was just 9 years of age, and some of the suffering that he himself had to experience. It wasn't great suffering, but he was made fun of because he was awkward and he was not good at sports, and he was much more bookish, loved the library far more than the athletic field, and he faced some of the rejection of his colleagues. He saw the world heading towards war, and he saw pain and suffering out there in the world, and those were the major things that pushed him, or at least caused him to choose to go in the direction of atheism. But even those are, though they're closer to the core of what he was doing, they weren't the core. And I think, at least this is how I read Lewis and his autobiography, I think the core was his own desire for personal autonomy. He wanted to be his own man, the master of his fate, the captain of his soul, and person who didn't want to bow down to any deity, what he called a transcendental interferer. So it was that innate sinfulness that we're all born with that was at the core of his rejection of God.
It's part one of our three-part series on C.S. Lewis. Today, Lewis the Atheist, Dr. Joel Heck, author of the book From Atheism to Christianity, the story of C.S. Lewis, is our guest. When we come back, Lewis uses the term good atheist. What did he mean by it? Matt Harrison, Chris Rosebro, Aaron Wolf, Peter Bender, Todd Peppercorn, and Terry Mattingly will be speaking at the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference Friday, June 9th and Saturday, June 10th in Collinsville, Illinois, about 15 miles east of St. Louis. Registration is $120. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armed forces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armed forces.
A new seminary student spends more than $300 on Greek textbooks. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, wants to reduce this financial burden with the Logos Project. Our goal is to raise funds to provide each of our new pastoral ministry students with the resources they need to begin their study. The Logos Project runs through May 19th. Learn more at generosity.ctsfw.edu. Help future pastors begin their journey with the Word of God. generosity.ctsfw.edu.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. on this Thursday afternoon. It's our series on C.S. Lewis, Part 1, Lewis the Atheist. Dr. Joel Heck is our guest. Lewis used the term good atheist. I wonder, Dr. Heck, what did he mean by that?
Yes, I think it's a little bit autobiographical. I think he thought himself as a good atheist, although he never really describes himself in that way. But I think he fits the bill. So he's aware that there are atheists out there that have adopted atheism because they see all the suffering in the world that he's seen, maybe other variations of it, maybe additional ones or some of the same things, and sees the injustice in the world when some child contracts childhood cancer, or there's a tsunami in the Indian Ocean, or an earthquake that causes a lot of suffering, and has concern about that pain and suffering, and says, if some things like this happen, there can't possibly be a God, because how could God allow these sorts of things? So a good atheist is a person who rejects God not because he sees no evidence for God, but because he sees pain and suffering in the world and doesn't really know how to explain it.
You also point out in the book that his literary pursuits and interests were formative, at least in confirming his views on atheism. How would you describe that, Dr. Heck?
Well, there were several atheists that he read. He had adopted atheism before he went to study with William T. Kirkpatrick, his private tutor for 2.5 years. But Kirkpatrick helped to confirm him in his atheism, and so he read Nietzsche and Schopenhauer, two famous intellectual atheists. He also read Lucretius, who was a Roman poet and writer of the first century B.C., if I remember correctly, B.C. or A.D., I forget which, but whom he quotes in his autobiography that since the world shows so much suffering, it can't possibly be the product of a good God. So he identified with what Lucretius had to say probably shortly after he became an atheist. So there were other authors that he read that helped to confirm him in his atheism, but probably those three in particular, Lucretius, Nietzsche, and Schopenhauer.
What did the First World War, obviously a deep impact on everyone who had some experience with it, what kind of impact did it have on Lewis and his atheism?
Well, we're talking about 1914 to 1918, and Lewis became an atheist either in late 1912 or early 1913. So we can't say that the war caused it, although, like I say, with Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, that it confirmed him in his atheism. And we have a tendency to adopt certain positions, and then we filter every experience that we have, whether it's reading a book or seeing something happen. We filter those through that worldview or that aspect of our understanding of life, and Lewis did that as well, and he fought in the war. He was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Somerset Infantry and ended up being in France on his 19th birthday. And I saw some really horrific things. A sergeant of his died because of friendly fire in an explosion that actually injured him and sent him to the hospital, probably saved his life because he was in the hospital. But the shell that injured him killed that sergeant, so he saw colleagues dying, he saw the enemy dying, he saw all this fighting and this slugging it out in the trench warfare of the First World War, and he was very much aware of the Battle of the Somme, S-O-M-M-E, in France, even though he didn't fight in it. Fortunately for him, he came into the war in the last year of the war, suffered from trench fever and was hospitalized to recover from that, and then was injured, real seriously, but was hospitalized for that. So much of the last year, actually a little less than a full year that he fought at the end of the war, he was not on the battlefield because of the illness and the injury. So those sorts of experiences probably saved his life. But he saw a lot of pain and suffering and death all around him, and fatigue and bombing and gunfire and so on, just almost constantly. So it soured him on the sorry state of the world, which one can really understand if one looks around at our world today. In virtually every era of history, there's been plenty of suffering, which makes the light of the gospel shine all the brighter when we think about that as followers of Jesus Christ.
So that old saying, there are no atheists in foxholes, for Lewis, at least at that point, during wartime, probably proved to be inaccurate. Those foxhole experiences only served to harden his atheism.
Yeah, I agree with that. He was an atheist when he was fighting in the war, and though as I looked at the whole thing about foxholes versus trenches, it seems to me that the foxhole came a little bit later in history, but the trench warfare of the First World War would have been the equivalent, and he was an atheist in a foxhole, and his experiences simply confirmed him in his atheism.
We talked earlier about his literary intake. He wasn't avoiding Christian authors. There's several, MacDonald and G.K. Chesterton, namely, that he read, and he even reflected later on Chesterton's writings that he probably should have been more careful as an atheist about what he was reading.
Yes, he quotes George Herbert a lot. Herbert was very influential as well, and all those authors I mentioned in that second chapter. But he has this clever way of putting things that makes him one of the most quoted, maybe the most quoted Christian author in our world today. You can't be too careful if you're an atheist, because there are traps lying for you everywhere, which is an allusion to George Herbert. So if you read things that are written by Christians, well, even those, a lot of things written by non-Christians or movies with great themes, anything that's really powerful and gripping has some ideas or some themes that have a lot of similarity to the fundamental message of sin and grace that the Scripture offers to us. So yeah, you have to be careful, and that's one of the honest moments in Lewis's writing. Well, he's always honest, it seems to me. Very straightforward, very willing to admit his errors if somebody pointed them out. He would argue with you and usually win those arguments, but he had an open mind and was willing to hear an opposing point of view, not only in conversation, but as you point out, especially in his reading. He would read the other side because he wasn't afraid of the other side, because he wanted to know truth rather than error or be deceived by what he was reading.
With the last few minutes here, Dr. Heck, we're familiar today with the so-called new atheist. They often present their atheism couched in terms of a naturalist worldview, usually bringing alongside the banner of science, things like that. And they give the impression of having thought it through thoroughly, all the implications of their beliefs, although you just scratch the surface and you realize many of even the most famous atheists haven't thought it through. Had Lewis, during the, if we could call it the nadir of his alienation from God, had he really thought it all through, this towering intellect of a man?
Probably not, although the 14-year-old atheist, C.S. Lewis, was probably a much deeper thinker than we sometimes give him credit for. I mean, he wasn't the typical 14-year-old, so we think, yeah, adopting atheism at age 14, well, he stubbed his toe a few times and he had some bad experiences, so he adopted atheism without thinking a whole lot. I don't know that that's a fair statement to make, because he was a very precocious young man. He read widely. He read John Milton's entire Paradise Lost at the age of 9 for the first time. So he was reading widely and thinking deeply. So even at 14, he had given it a pretty good look, but I think he had looked at the Christian faith and the suffering of the world with a biased perspective and was really wanting to come to a particular position and ended up adopting the position that he really desired to be true. That's a little bit of an evasive answer, so I guess I'm saying yes and no, both.
With only about 30 seconds, had he remained an atheist, and so many of his intellectual colleagues did remain atheists, but had he remained one, I'm asking you to speculate, would we know of the name of C.S. Lewis?
I think we probably would, simply because of the strength of his intellect. He might have stayed in philosophy, but even if he'd been in literature, he would have written some powerful and useful things, but certainly not, we wouldn't know him nearly as well as we know him today.
Dr. Joel Heck is professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, visiting professor at Concordia Lutheran Seminary in Canada, author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month, From Atheism to Christianity, the story of C.S. Lewis. You can read it for yourself. Just order it from Concordia Publishing House. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Next time, we'll talk with Dr. Heck about C.S. Lewis's conversion to Christianity. Dr. Heck, thank you.
You're very welcome.
When we come back, Glenn Stanton will talk about the loss of manhood.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you have a student finishing up eighth grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.